Teach Me to Code, podcast episode 21, interview with Miles Forrest, part 1. Hello, coders, and welcome back to another Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to play a discussion that I had with Miles Forrest. I don't know if I could technically call it an interview, since he kind of interviewed me and I kind of interviewed him, so... Anyway, we had a great talk. We talked about just, you know, following your passion in programming and forming Ruby brigades and things like that. Now, we did talk for about an hour, which was about 45 minutes longer than we should have, since his son came in the middle of the interview and asked him to turn it down, which meant turn himself down. But anyway, we talked for about an hour and really just had a great discussion. If you don't know, Miles is the host of the Coder Path podcast, and he does it with Curtis McHale. I met him at Mountain West RubyConf, and I met him at RailsConf last year. And he was just super gracious and friendly, and we just had a good discussion. Before we get started, I do want to remind you that this podcast is sponsored. It's sponsored by New Relic, so keep an ear out for where to get their information on the other end of the podcast. And with all that said, I'm just going to go ahead and play the interview, and we'll pick you up on the other side. All right, before I get too far, I just need to... I forgot on the last couple of episodes of the podcast that I did promise a couple of books from the Pragmatic Programmers to people who left reviews on iTunes. The winners are Brad Canton and George Webster. So if you're listening to this, then you've won a book. They are the books by James Edward Gray. The first one is the Best of Ruby Quiz, and that's what's going out to Brad Canton. And George Webster has won the TextMate book. So anyway, thanks for the reviews. I'd like to remind everybody else to please go to iTunes and leave a review. You can do that by just doing a search for Teach Me to Code podcast. And it should show up there, and then you can leave me a review, and that would just be awesome. If you're enjoying the screencasts, I encourage you to do the same thing there. It really helps. I don't know that I have anything else to cover, so like I said before, I'm just going to take you right into the interview. So here it is, and I hope you enjoy it.
What are you using to pick up, record the audio?
When I do Skype interviews, I've been using Wiretap Studio Pro. And it works like a dream. It's really good. I had a few problems with it initially, but I just upgraded Skype and Wiretap, and it works great now.
Nice.
And
I've been using Call Recorder for just regular podcasting, but I use Wiretap Studio as well. It's a great little product.
Yep. Yeah, when I'm just doing it myself, I've been using GarageBand, and I haven't had any problems with it. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, this is odd because I'm both the interviewer and the interviewee, and you are the interviewer and the interviewee.
It's true, you know. I just thought we could chat, you know, talk about programming, talk about podcasting, and
sure,
you know, whatever's interesting.
Sure. Well, I'm kind of curious now. I actually just started listening to your Rails Coach recently. I just kind of found it. How long have you been doing the podcast for?
Well. I did my first interview with Greg Pollock in October of last year, but I didn't get everything together to start publishing things until December. So, that's when
fairly recently, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And how many episodes you have now?
I released my 18th episode this morning.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. It looks like you've got, 7 interviews with some pretty big names in the Ruby community, and I've really been enjoying listening to them and, you know, hearing some of the people that you've been able to talk to.
Well, thank you. There are actually not 7 interviews with, there is a couple episodes, number 2 and 3 that were just Curtis and myself.
Oh, that's right.
The Ruby and the Rails community have been very easy to approach and to get interviews and talk to people. It's been really enjoyable for me to be able to talk shop, and well, here I say talking shop when I'm not even really a professional programmer. But No, it's been really good. I actually started off about 3 years ago doing some screencasting. Uh-huh. And I did a screencast with DHH and Amy Hoy and Ryan Bates. And originally, when I started the screencast, I had this vision that I would do pair programming, that I would pair with these people and help learn and stuff. And pair programming is just really, really hard to do when you're not sitting in the same room with somebody. And you can do remote pair programming, but I haven't had success with it, especially with people that I don't really know that well.
Yeah, so. It's hard when you do know people and you're sitting in the same room. So,
how long have you been programming for?
Well, I went to Brigham Young University and I got my degree in computer engineering, and that's kind of where I got started. I mean, I'd fiddled with things when I was in junior high and high school, but, you know, nothing that was any big thing. You know, it just kind of introduced me to some of the, you know, general controls you see, like loops and if and then and all that stuff. And I got into professional programming about 4 years ago. And it's actually kind of funny because I was on a management track. I was working for Mozy, which is a company that was bought out by EMC Corporation about 3.5-4 years ago. And what happened was we didn't have the tools that we needed to effectively manage the workload that we had. And so me and another guy, we just started building it. And he was familiar with Ruby on Rails, so he started building it there, and I just kind of picked it up as I went. And after about 3 or 4 months of working on that system, I was actually looking forward to the programming time and dreading all of my other work. So when the opportunity presented itself, I moved from management to QA, and 6 months later, I moved from QA to development.
Yeah, I started hacking around with computers back in the 80s. No formal training in programming. I was trained actually as an electronics technician, and went from fixing ATBD scramblers into information technology. So I used a lot of my hardware knowledge to repair servers. And back then, when you actually physically got in and had to change jumpers for IRQs and all that other good stuff. So it was... It was a nifty transition, actually. But programming has always been this thing sort of in the back of my mind that I was always attracted to. Back in the 80s, when I was a teenager, I discovered the modem. And a friend of mine had a 300 baud auto modem for his Commodore 64. And I wanted one, so I saved up all my pennies and I bought this broken auto modem from a guy out of the buy and sell. And then I took it to an electronics shop and I got it repaired, and that started my whole online world. So I ran a bulletin board for years, and I really wanted to write my own BBS software. So I started writing it in BASIC, and I used a BASIC compiler, and it was just terrible. I mean, it would crash, lock up every night, and I'd lose messages and everything. But it was so much fun being able to create something out of nothing. And I diverged paths. I kind of got tired of computers and went into electronics, and then ended up getting back into computers, and now here I am, I'm 40 years old, and I'm starting my career over as wanting to be a programmer, so I just couldn't get away from it.
That's funny, but, you know, it's kind of the same, we're talking about kind of the same thing, and it's something that I've tried to stress in my podcasts and in some of the articles that I've written and stuff, and that is that, you know, you have to do what you love. I mean, you know, if you're not doing it, and I listened to your going to Mountain West RubyConf, and you and Curtis were talking about that, you know, just doing what you love and finding that fulfillment. And I'll tell you, you know, if you don't love your work, life is so hard. It is so hard.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally hear what you say. I have three major loves in my life. My first is my Lord and Savior. I'm a born-again Christian, New Testament, all that. The second is my wife and family. And the third is the work that I do. And the funny thing is that the first two, you kind of can't drop those. Mm-hmm. But with work, you can drop work and you can have it fail and you can just pick it up again and kind of keep coming back to it. But that's kind of what I've done. I work professionally as a web technologist for a local school district. And I always kind of keep coming back to programming, and I was bailing at it and left it, and then came back. And you know, the beautiful thing about work is it never gets upset with you. You never have to repent and come back to it. It's always there waiting for you. So I live a very blessed life. I'm having so much fun, and now the podcast has been doing well, and talking to a lot of interesting people, and just connecting and giving back to a community that I really enjoy, and really have met just an amazing number of people. It's nice to be able to kind of give back to something that I really enjoy.
Yeah, it's true, and you know, you did mention that the Ruby community has been very open and willing to participate, and you know, I've really seen the same thing. I mean, you know, I emailed Greg Pollock out of the blue, you know, and just kind of said, well, hey, you know, I've been listening to podcasts for years, and you know, I'm really interested in starting my own, and what do you think? And he emailed me back basically saying, that's totally awesome. You should totally do it. And here's what you need to do. And here are all the things you have to do. And here's how you get involved in this and that. And I mean, it was really funny because I just got this enthusiastic reply. And, you know, I kind of approach things as, well, gee, you know, these people, they have audiences of thousands of people. And, you know, there's no way that they're ever going to care, you know, that some, you know, dumb little 28-year-old in Utah, or 30-year-old, I'm 30 now, you know, is going to want to start a podcast. And, you know, it was exactly the opposite. And, you know, talking to people that are extremely busy, like James Edward Gray or Dave Thomas, who I interviewed recently, you know, I mean, these guys are totally like, yeah, let's talk, let's, you know, let's do it. And it's just amazing how open they are to it, even though, I mean, they have tons and tons of things going on, you know, that could easily take up the time that I'm taking.
Yeah, you know, that's been my same experience meeting with people. And it's kind of funny how you talked to Greg and Greg kind of gave you some starting with podcasting. I actually met Greg and Greg and
Jason Cipher.
Jason's gonna kill me. I met Greg and Jason Cipher at, I think it was RailsConf 2006, and they had just showed up, and they had these videos that they put together, you know, Rails versus PHP and everything. And I met
those
them
were
in the
funny.
Lunch. They were, and I had my podcasting mic, and I was talking with Dr. Nick, and these guys had just shown one of their videos, so I started interviewing them for a little experiment that I did called a Tumblecast. It was like a little 5-minute podcast. And they got asking me, hey, how do you do podcasting? So I was saying, oh, you get this mic and do this and everything. So they went off and they just totally rocked it. And it's really neat how this whole community kind of encourages one another, and we kind of, you know, here I'll share with you with what I know.
At this point, Miles' son Aiden walked in, so there was a little bit of dead air and muffled speaking, so I've actually taken this out, and it'll pick up right after he walks out.
Well, Charles, I need to turn it down. I need to talk a little softer, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm in the room right next to my 4-year-old, and I'm probably keeping him awake too, so...
Nice. How many children do you have?
I have 3 children. I have a 4-year-old boy, a 3-year-old girl, and a 1-year-old girl.
Oh my goodness! You're still in the diaper stage with.
Yeah. Just with one, thank heaven. But
and you're doing a podcast.
Have you been to teachmetocode.com?
You know, I've seen it. I haven't actually started viewing the episodes. Why?
Because I've been putting those videos together as well. I stay busy.
Oh, you must have a very gracious wife.
Oh, you have no idea.
No, I do. I have a 8-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter, and we were in a cramped little three-bedroom townhouse for quite a number of time when I started experimenting with things. And I had an office that was way at the bottom floor, and they were at the very top. But now we've since then we bought a house and sold a house and bought another house, and now we're really enjoying where we're at. But the wall, I'm going to have to figure out a new recording setup if I'm going to be doing these late lessons.
Yeah, we actually moved into this house on Saturday, or not 2 days ago Saturday, but a week ago Saturday.
And you're doing a pot, man. You gotta give me some time management secrets.
Well, my time management went like this. I didn't release a screencast or a podcast episode last week.
Oh no, you missed a week.
I did.
Well, I haven't. I was supposed to have a podcast out today, and got busy with things. And so it's not out yet, but hopefully I'll get it out either tonight or tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how many listeners do you have on your podcast?
I'm not exactly sure how many listeners, because we can play it through the web or through iTunes. You can also get it through archive.org, which is where I host all of my content.
Uh-huh.
But I have probably about 1,100 subscribers.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
but I started with a base of about 450 that were holdouts from the old screencasts.
Oh, okay.
So yeah. I kind of had a bit of head start.
Yeah, you did. You started about where I'm at now. According to FeedBurner, I have about 400 subscribers, but I just signed up for Libsyn about a month ago, mm-hmm. and. The podcast got just over 2,000 downloads last month, and the first 4 days of this month I got 500 downloads cold. So
nice. Yeah, I used to use Liberated Syndication years ago. It has really nice statistics in it. I just cheaped out this time. I decided to put all my content on archive.org and just release it through Creative Commons. And then I wrote my own simple Rails application to serve it and using Heroku. And it works pretty good.
Yeah, that makes sense. My thing was, is I really wanted to see, you know, where the traffic was and what was going on. So, you know, I cough up the $12 a month so that I can get the statistics. And, you know, I think it's worth it. It's also nice because, you know, they have the distributed network and all that stuff. So, you know, you get the fast downloads for the latest 4 or 5 episodes, and you know, it's something that really works for me, and I'm pretty happy with it. So,
yeah, I would have gone back to Liberated Syndication or Libsyn, but actually, I didn't want to have as clear statistics as I did before, and the reason was when I started CoderPath, it was quite successful early on. I had probably about 900 subscribers, and combined with YouTube and everything, I had about 50,000 downloads of the screencast in about a year. And I got a lot of email from people, and it got to the point where the success of it was actually a detriment. I actually have two old episodes that I never aired. One was with I can't remember who they were now. I think one was with Nathaniel Talbot. And you know, these guys were very gracious to give their time, but when I started editing it all together, it didn't work. It felt probably like it should have been more of a podcast rather than the screencast I was trying to attempt. Mm-hmm. And so I let it kind of languish for the longest time, and I decided this time that I wasn't going to pay attention too much to stats. Because I didn't want to focus so much on how successful the podcast is or how many people are. I mean, I certainly understand why, and I do have some stats on it. But I get really nervous when I start thinking about I lost some subscribers. Have you ever heard of these Twitter services that tell you when people stop following you?
Yes, I've seen them. I don't sign up for them because I pretty much just don't care. I mean, I'll put out what I think is interesting, and if people ask for something specific, then I'll do that. But ultimately, I just want to know that I'm helping people, and that's where the stats come in for me.
Yeah, you're a bigger man than me because I for me it was just all ego.
there's a little of that.
Oh yeah, it's really fun, especially when you go to the conferences and you get introduced to people, and it's like, oh yeah, I saw your stuff and I saw your work, and that's really kind of one of the things that we like, is we want the recognition of our peers for doing good work, and mm-hmm. I don't think it's bad to have a little bit of a little bit of pride to say, hey, I did a good job, and to have a little pat on the back. For me, it was just. It's kind of hard to explain what it was. It was just it did so well, and then I became all obsessed about the numbers. Mm-hmm. So the reason I mentioned that Twitter follower thing is I also had the same problem there, where I started following and then people would stop following me, and I go, oh, what did I do wrong? And so it wasn't until probably about a year and a half, 2 years ago, that I finally just decided, you know what, I'm just going to do the best I can and put it out there. And if people don't like it,
Hello?
Put stuff out. And it's taken a lot of the stress off. I'm not worried so much about being successful anymore as much as I'm just trying to do good work. And some people don't like it, which is totally fine. They don't have to listen. They don't have to subscribe. And more people, more often than not, have really enjoyed the podcast and the old screencasts. And but my real ultimate goal is to get to programming more.
Mm-hmm.
And sharing code, and I look forward to the day when I can go to a conference and somebody says, "Oh, hey, Miles, I really like that gem you wrote." That to me will be a success. That'll be our one. It's when I have achieved that.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I do a lot of it because I enjoy it. It was funny because I took over Teach Me to Code from Eric Berry. And, he'll put out a couple of screencasts about Groovy and Grails. But, I've been maintaining the Ruby podcast, every week or screencasts, I guess. And it's interesting, just how many people are interested. And if I miss a week, that they care and that helps. But, ultimately, there are a couple of things that I really enjoy. And one is just that, I get to show something that I'm interested in and kind of share my interest. And, my feeling really is that if people don't agree with me and it bothers them, then they can unsubscribe, and I'm okay with that. And if it helps them out and they want to let me know, I'm great with that too, because then I know that I'm on the right track and that there are other people interested in the same thing that I am. When I first got started, podcasting, it was a lot about, is anyone listening, Yeah, and the only thing I really saw was the numbers going up on FeedBurner and things like that, as opposed to getting any feedback, which is what I really wanted. And after a while, I just decided, you know what? If nobody wants it, then nobody will listen to it, or nobody will, watch the screencasts. But it turns out that there are a lot of people that are interested in the same thing that I am. And with that being the case, I mean, it's just been well worth it. And, I'm interested in contributing code, but I don't see that as my main fulfillment in this project. For me, it's more just being able to to contribute in those ways and see what I can do to help people out. And that's kind of why I took the focus of building code better or becoming better at what you do, as opposed to specific things with Ruby or Rails or some of the other languages and frameworks that are out there. Because really, I don't care what your tool is, as long as you're building stuff that's worth using.
Yeah, the whole tool versus language sort of divide has been interesting for me to learn. I can't remember where the blog article was, but somebody pointed out this distinction that there are sort of two camps. there are programmers who tend to gravitate towards just a simple text editor and mastering the language, and then there are those that sort of gravitate towards the ID and the tool. Mm-hmm. And the people that gravitate towards the IE, they don't really care so much about the language, because a lot of it is just quite generic. It's high level. It's what the tool will let me do. Whereas people that are most using a text editor, they dig into the language and they get into the nuances and things, and they become very passionate about what language of choice. And I wonder sometimes if the conflict that you see has to do with just the different styles that people have. People that perhaps really are more interested in the language, it's obviously when you work with something and you get good at it, then it's something you care about and it's important to you.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's very true. Yeah. Now I have another question for you. When we were at Mountain West RubyConf, you know, I met some of your other buddies from up in the area that you live in, like Dan Cubb and Curtis McHale and some of these other guys. You know, did it just happen that you all are from that area? I mean, because it's kind of like, I mean, you all contribute to the community in your own way, and I just thought it was interesting that the three or four guys that were kind of all hanging out together from what was it, British Columbia?
Mm-hmm.
They all happen to be, you know, contributors in the way of a podcast or, being the primary maintainer on Datamapper or, you know, things like that. I just thought that was interesting. Did you just kind of all find each other and happen to be friends that way?
I'll give you the story on that. When I moved to Chilliwack, which is where I live, it's at the far east end of the Fraser Valley in British Columbia. So if you look at a map of BC, you'll see kind of a whole bunch of cities all along the bottom. That's because we're hemmed in by mountains. So we've got mountains above us. We've got mountains to the east of us. So Chilliwack is right up against the mountains on the east side. And Vancouver, everybody knows where Vancouver is. It's a big populated area. And after the screencast started to not really work out the way I'd hoped, I started tried to get involved in some of the local Ruby brigades. And the closest one was in Vancouver, which is about an hour and a half drive from here. So I started getting involved in there, and the club was kind of waning. It was at that time it was run by Jeremy Hubert and Zed Shaw, who was a Vancouver native. And I showed up right when Zed had had enough of all the rain and the wet of Vancouver. So Zed headed down to Florida. So the group kind of dispersed, and I tried to kind of lead it, but it was just really hard for this guy, Chilliwack, to be running this remote group, so it kind of fell apart. So I started going down to the Seattle Ruby Brigade, which is about 2.5 hours from where I live. So here it would be like a Tuesday night after work. I would get off at 4:30. I would hop in my car, and I would drive straight down to Seattle. It would take 2.5, 3 hours. And I'd get there, and I'd hang out at this coffee shop, and I didn't really know anybody, and I didn't know how to talk. But there I met Jeffrey Grossenbach and Ryan.
Ryan Bates?
Not Ryan Bates. Ryan Davis.
Okay.
Who's written Ho and all. You know, I can tell this is nighttime because my brain is starting to shut down here. When I get tired, my brain goes to mush. Eric Odell, who, in a Seattle Ruby Brigade, the amount of stuff that they put out there is just incredible. So I was saying all that to say that I wanted this, but location wise, it just wasn't working out. So I tried starting a Ruby Brigade. I had actually been in the process of starting my own clubs here in Chilliwack, and I took three tries at it, and each one of them failed. So I would, you know, put out ads and reserve a room, and nobody would show up. Or I would, I did a club one time, and I figured, well, I'd take an open source slant to it, and it was called Phosphor. And I had like two people show up, and then they didn't show up anymore. So it was, you know, it was getting kind of discouraging. And last year, that was January 20th, I think, 2009, I started up the Fraser Valley Ruby Brigade, and put it signed up on meetup.com. And we had a couple people coming out, and this time I decided, you know what, I'm just going to commit to show up, even if nobody else shows up, and I'm just going to keep coming there week after week after week. And I got the inspiration to take the approach that Ryan Davis did at Ryan Davis and Eric Hodel at Seattle Ruby Brigade, where they just focused on hack nights. So instead of trying to do a club and trying to do a presentation, I just said, you know what, I just want to get together with other people and work on code. And so that's what our user group, Fraser Valley Ruby Brigade, is all about. We just call it FVRB. FVRB is we meet every night, every Wednesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. at a local coffee shop in a place called Abbotsford. And it's a real rural area that we live in. We got a lot of cows, we got a lot of cornfields, and people started showing up. But when Dan Cubb came and he talked about this project Data Mapper, I hadn't even heard of Data Mapper. So it's been over the last year and a half that more people have shown up, and our sort of coming out party was at Mountain West RubyConf this past year, and that's where you met five of us that we all went down, and that was about half the club. We went there, and so that's, you know, it was a long arduous climb to get to where we are, but it's really been worth it, and you know. Mm-hmm. It's now, something I care about. So,
now how long ago did you kind of get this together, get it going?
It was January 20th, 2009. So we're looking at about almost a year and a half.
Hmm. That's really, really interesting. And I think it really just speaks to, you know, if you're persistent, then you can achieve it. And I think that's really true of a lot of things, but, you know, especially in coding, you know, if you're persistent, then you can learn and achieve what you need to.
Well, that is one gift I have, is I am very mule-headed and willing to keep trying and trying and trying. And mm-hmm. I probably should have given up a long time ago, but I'm just too stupid to quit. So
I don't know about that. It sounds like it paid off.
It's done very well, but...
All right. Well, we'd just like to thank Miles once again for coming on the podcast. He was just a pleasure to talk to. And, you know, I really, really appreciate it. Go check out his podcast. He's talked to some pretty interesting people at coderpath.com. Also, one more thing. This podcast is sponsored by New Relic. And New Relic is the leading provider of application performance management tools for Ruby and Java applications. Thousands of companies use New Relic RPM to monitor, troubleshoot, and optimize applications deployed either in the cloud or in dedicated hosting environments. And RPM Lite is actually free and fully supported. It's a limited time. I mean, you can use it as long as you want. You can, and you can get it at www.newrelic.com. And, you know, it's interesting because all the leading Rails companies out there use New Relic. I mean, 37 Signals, AT&T Interactive, Shopify, Our Stage, IGN, just tons of them. I actually use it, and I think it's a great service. So go check them out, www.newrelic.com. And thanks for coming. Build better code. We'll catch you next week.